loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In the first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, an independent inquest has found that Stephen Clark, the black man killed by police in Sacramento last week in his own backyard, was shot 8 times. 6 of those shots were from behind. Protests in Sacramento have erupted since Clark was killed, and protests are now taking place all over the country. Then, Israeli soldiers killed 17 Palestinians and wounded at least 1,400 people on Friday during Land Day demonstrations in Gaza. 20 Palestinians remain in critical conditions. No Israelis were killed or wounded. Why would these protesters put their lives on the line? What are they fighting for? And what about the Israeli brutality? More than 750 people shot with live ammunition in just 1 day.
But before we get to a report on the killing of Stephen Clark, we'll go over today's headlines, including 5 that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt got a favorable and inexpensive rent deal from a Capitol Hill lobbyist whose clients include energy industry and fossil fuel clients. The EPA published several retroactive approvals of the deal despite the lobbyist holding the apartment for Pruitt at a below-market $50 a night rate and only charging Pruitt for the nights that he stayed there. This news is after a long line of incredibly expensive travel on the taxpayer's dollar. Campaigning is now officially underway for Mexico's general election that will see the country elect a new president. The leading candidate is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a progressive former mayor of Mexico City who is considered most likely to confront the Trump administration. Obrador's main opponents are Ricardo Anaya, José Meade, and Margarita Zavala. Following months of deadly protest by the country's Oromo people, Ethiopia's new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, was sworn in by parliament today. Ahmed is the country's first Oromo prime minister. Ahmed's selection by the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front is an attempt to reduce tensions. Protests and deadly repression rocked India yesterday and today, leaving nearly 30 people dead. In the disputed region of Kashmir, at least 20 were killed in protests and clashes during operations carried out by Indian authorities. Meanwhile, protests by Dalits and others against the weakening of caste discrimination laws saw at least 7 people killed. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a report on the killing of Stephen Clark. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
An independent inquest has found that Stephen Clark, the African-American man killed in his own backyard by police in Sacramento last week, was shot 8 times. 6 of those bullets were from behind. Protests in Sacramento have grown steadily since Clark was killed, and sympathetic protests have taken place now all over the country. We're joined from Sacramento by Jameer Sal. He is an activist with the Answer Coalition, and he's been one of the principal organizers organizing the protests that have been in the streets in Sacramento during the past days. We're joined from San Francisco by Gloria LaRiva. She is the Peace and Freedom Party 2018 California gubernatorial candidate. And we're joined from Chicago by Aislinn Borsini. She is an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Welcome to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Jameer, let's start with you. You're at Ground Zero. You're in Sacramento. You were one of the principal organizers of the protests that have been in the streets since this incident happened. We had the police now using police cruisers to ram into protesters. You were there. What happened with that?
Well, we were marching up Florin Road. We were calling for justice. You know, our chants were very focused on Stephen Clark, and really, you know, it was about say his name, Stephen Clark. And you know, as we're marching up Florin, I noticed I was more on the right side of the lanes, and over on the left, I noticed two police cars just kind of randomly appear, and then, you know, out of nowhere, I see them speed off, and there's just a huge crowd, and I just hear people screaming. So I ran over there, And, you know, everyone just was saying, they hit her. And then I look on the ground, and there was Wanda Cleveland in the fetal position, you know, by the curb on the street. And it was really just shocking. I think everybody was really shocked. And especially, you know, not just that she was hit, but that the police just drove away. You know, and everyone kind of asked each other the same question, like, isn't this has to be illegal? This is a hit and run, you know. And, you know, we were really just in shock immediately. But, you know, very quickly our attention turned to making sure that she was okay. You know, we had to kind of clear the media out of the way because, you know, they're really coming in close and really giving space for her to get the medical attention she needed. And then the ambulance arrived shortly afterwards. But really, it was just a shocking scene of brutality on the side of law enforcement. Really something I've never witnessed before. I'm still in shock.
Yeah, that is shocking. I mean, these cops, I mean, the Sacramento police, like so many police departments around the country, are really functioning like their own little death squads. And then if people come out and protest and they have peaceful protests, let's take the police cruiser and run it right into the protest, like, you know, like the white supremacists did in Charlottesville. Gloria LaRiva, let's get your take. You were there also?
Yes, I was there. We were in this protest. But the really amazing thing is, as Jameer said, we just, after she was rescued and taken to the hospital, we kept on moving and marching. And then the police decided, oh, this is going to really heat up. And they brought several cop cars to block the intersection. And we occupied the intersection. And the youth forced the police to leave because there was so much anger. And they left, and the march continued. And for the rest of the night, there was no need for police. There never is in these marches. People were very disciplined. And then as we went by the sheriff's office headquarters, because they're the ones who had the helicopters reporting that there was a man, you know, with a weapon in his hand, and they were the ones directing the police on the ground before they shot Stephon Clark. They had another helicopter above us ordering us to leave, saying you will be arrested if you don't disperse. And they could hear us as we chanted, "We're not going. Hell no, we won't go." And then even they disappeared. So that happened a week ago also, the same thing near our office when the march ended, that the police, there were dozens of police cars, dozens of cops blocking, thinking they had to put the hammer down on people, and the youth forced them to leave. It's an amazing show of discipline and determination of the people in Sacramento.
We've seen remarkable unity coming out of the killing of Stephon Clark. Unity in that these protests against the shooting and killing of unarmed African American men, police brutality. It's spreading around the country. We've seen large scale protests in places like San Antonio, Texas, Baltimore yesterday. Aislinn Borsini, you're an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago. What are we seeing in Chicago?
Well, we have, Chicago has a number of actions that are going to happen this week. We have a pretty big one that's planned for Wednesday, which is, you know, the actual anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. It will be the 50th year. And in that, we will be marching in solidarity with all of the fighters in Sacramento, demanding justice for Stephon Clark. We will also be lifting up the Cynthia Clement, who was killed by suburban Chicago police March 12th, which is almost, you know, we're almost at the 1 month anniversary of her murder. And we will be lifting up the countless other names of people who have been killed by CPD, including Laquan McDonald, Ronnie Man Johnson, Pierre Laurie, whose 2 year anniversary of his murder is coming up on April 12th. And Wednesday also marks the 4 year anniversary of the murder of Justice Howell, who was killed by another suburban Chicago cop. So there are so many people that we will be marching for and lifting up their names and lifting up their fights. and marching in solidarity with all of the fighters in Sacramento.
That's the voice of Aislinn Borsini. She's with the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago. We're talking also with Gloria LaRiva in San Francisco. She's running for governor in California in the 2018 election as the Peace and Freedom Party candidate. And we're speaking also with Jameer Sale. Jameer is one of the organizers in Sacramento of the protests that have been in the streets and have become sort of a magnet, as John Kiriakou was mentioning, for protests that are now sweeping the country. It's really important that Wednesday is the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the killing of Dr. King. The day after the killing of Dr. King, the very next day, really starting that night, cities went into rebellion. 120 cities, quote, burned down. I was looking at the Washington Post just this weekend. They've done a multimedia sort of look back at what happened that day. And the galling thing about it was that everything we're learning today, 50 years later, about what happened with the killing of Dr. King and then the rebellions or insurrections, what are called race riots or looting by the popular media, are being depicted now through these multimedia presentations by the Washington Post from the eyes and through the viewpoint of the police and from the viewpoint of Secret Service here in Washington, D.C., because the Washington Post got all of these documents showing how the police thought, what they were afraid of, or what they said they were afraid of. You know, whenever they kill somebody, they say, well, I feared for my life. So now we're 50 years later, we're learning through these sort of instruments of establishment media, how terrible those responses were to the murder of Dr. King, as if the entire insurrection that took place in America, and I can remember it vividly because I was 15 years old at the time, was nothing more than just opportunist looting rather than what it really was, which was an insurrection, an uprising of an entire people. Jameer, this is not the way things were in 1968. But the unmediated oppression of black communities, black and brown communities, is such that the potential really for nationwide uprising still exists. And maybe even now the government realizes the peaceful protests can be the precursor to something even larger. And yet no real reforms are being carried out, no disciplining of the police. And if the powers that be wanted to discipline the police, they certainly could, but they don't. I mean, anyway, what's your take? You're a younger person. How do you feel and think about this on the anniversary of the killing of Dr. King?
Well, a couple things come to mind. The first thing is we've always been saying this, that COINTELPRO never went away. You know, all it did was change forms. You know, so we remember the reports that came out about the Occupy activists being surveilled, Black Lives Matter activists being surveilled, you know, the most recent incident with the black identity extremists, and, you know, really the assault on any kind of growth of a black liberation movement that's not tied to the establishment and ran by the NAACP or the Urban League and kind of that liberal establishment, anything outside of that that represents the interests of the people is really something that's a threat to the system. And so they're constantly working against that. And, you know, we see it in the form of undercover agents at our demonstrations. And we know that, you know, there's things working against us. But at the same time, we realize that the force that's on our side in the power of the people is stronger than any of these forces of repression. And so the other thing is really I became more active around January of 2014. So August of that year, obviously, Mike Brown was murdered and Ferguson happened. After that, Baltimore happened. And we were very, central to organizing protests in solidarity with those demonstrations. And every time we would talk about that with citizens of Sacramento, young people and just regular working class people, they would tell us, you know, we're facing the same thing. You know, we would hear stories about people getting arrested 4, 5, 6, 7 times in a single week. We would hear stories about people being scared to leave their homes to go to the corner store because they'll be stopped and searched and asked questions and they wouldn't know what would happen to them. So people have been being terrorized for a long time. And so this kind of objective oppression that's been imposed on our communities is something that people have been just kind of swallowing for so long, and people are fed up. And they've really had enough, and we're really starting to see people shake off their chains and really starting to rise up. And we're seeing that people are taking the streets, and people are really they're expressing themselves. And the biggest thing we have to do is create that space for them to have that expression.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Gloria LaRiva. I know you were in Ferguson. As I think Jameer was as well, and Aislinn, I don't know if you were. You may have been too. After the killing of Mike Brown, and Gloria, you were there video as a videographer. Partly, you were filming the police and what they were doing, and I think they shot you.
See, Jameer and I got there exactly 1 week after Michael Brown was murdered, and that Saturday was when the governor announced the curfew starting midnight. And we were there that night when the youth stood in the street doing nothing but standing to defy the curfew, the bullets and tear gas, rubber bullets. But the next night, the community came out, about 3,000 people, to march three hours before the curfew, when Jameer and I and quite a few members of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, along with the community, were marching, and suddenly five military vehicles blocked us and began firing away at us. Yes, I did get shot in the thigh with a rubber bullet. Those are fatal if you get hit in the head.
Oh, you bet they are.
And Jameer got, you know, cut up by barbed wire, having to climb over a fence to get away from the cops. Several of our people were arrested. It was just mayhem. Dozens of people were arrested. But it brings to mind, Ferguson became international. The struggle for him was national, because of the sustained rebellion and protest. And I see since then that Sacramento is rising up, and it is they have a lot of similarities. But I think that this one is extremely important because there have been literally probably 3,000 people murdered between Mike Brown and now.
Amazing.
And people are saying, not one more. And I want to say something about the gentrification of Sacramento. The city spent $255 million for the basketball team to have a stadium, the Sacramento Kings. And they're going to spend more than $150 million for downtown development of cultural centers for the rich. And the neighborhood where Stephon Clark was from, his family, is completely neglected. And Jameer knows more about that because he lives there.
Aislinn, let's go back to Aislinn Borsini. Aislinn, you know, John Kiriakou and I had the opportunity to talk to some of the students, the young people, teenagers, who were coming on a bus from Chicago for the March 24th March for Our Lives rally that was in solidarity with the Parkland students who had been shot. And these teenagers, these students who are coming from your city, were really remarkable. We interviewed them on the bus. They were halfway here, and there was four people. I think they were 16, 17 years old. They were talking about what the demands were, and they were so sophisticated. And the reason they were so sophisticated is that they had been part of the Black Lives Matter movement already for the last couple of years. So they were linking the struggle with gun violence to jobs, to police brutality, to housing, to mental health facilities. They were indicting the system. They weren't simply dealing with guns as like a single issue. And it just really struck me about how advanced they were for their age. And that's as a consequence of having been involved in earlier protests around the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago. And it just made it clear to me that we are witnessing right now, as a consequence of all of this activity in 2011 with Occupy, then, of course, the killing of Michael Brown, August 9, 2014, and the movement and the rebellions that came afterwards, Baltimore, what happened with the killing and the Freddie Gray, that a whole new generation of young organizers are being trained to be leaders and really thus are leaders. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Last week, we had about three actions that were all youth-led. We had students last week was spring break. And what these young people decided to do was do a week of action. And they took over City Hall on Wednesday, and they participated in the monthly city council meeting. They held teach-ins in City Hall. They did I don't know if you've seen any of the photos, but they did a display of headstones that listed a number of people who've been killed by CPD, as well as people like, you know, in other areas of the country, including Stephon Clark. They also listed schools that have been shut down. Rahm Emanuel conducted the largest mass public school closing in U.S. history, and just last month shut down four additional schools in Inglewood, which is one of the most impoverished neighborhoods in Chicago. Now that neighborhood has no public schools. And they listed, you know, a number of the mental health care centers that were closed. Rahm Emanuel closed half of the city's mental health centers in 2012. Their consciousness regarding being able to concretely see the consequences of divestment from social services into policing is remarkable. And they are leading the fight to demand that city council turn away and cancel their proposal to create a $95 million new police academy on the west side of Chicago. And they're demanding that $95 million be invested in schools. They're demanding an end to the closures, an end to the privatization, an end of the expansion of charter schools. We are definitely seeing a new layer of fighters as young as 12 years old who are able to concretely articulate what this system is doing, how it's creating violence, and how we need to change it.
Jameer Sale, I want to direct this question to you. So much has been made in the mainstream media, both print and broadcast, about the Sacramento Police Department Chief Daniel Hahn. He's the first African-American to be in this position. And the mainstream media is saying that there couldn't be a better person for this job right now. He has ceded the investigation to the state attorney general's office. He's made all the right noises in the press. Is that your impression of him too, and his conduct since this terrible shooting?
Absolutely not. Really, what we've seen is a full court press in the terms of press coverage and really damage control in the media. And so, you know, this police chief comes after Sam Summers, our previous police chief, who's very notorious around Sacramento. And he was basically pushed out because it was untenable for the political establishment to continue with just outright brutality. So we got kind of a compromise with Daniel Hahn. But Sam Summers is someone whose father was also the police chief back in the 80s, and he murdered somebody on the job that went unpunished. And so he was instrumental in kind of slowing that process for justice. So, you know, this new police chief is definitely a change, but I don't think it's a change in the sense of we went from a Republican to a Democrat. You know, we haven't left from the normal playbook of the police, which is really covering up for their officers, making sure that they get away with murder, and, you know, just making sure that this cycle of violence continues. And really, the spotlight has been on the chief so that they can keep the spotlight off of the sheriff. And the sheriff, their role in this was very instrumental in leading those police officers to Stephon Clark's backyard. And, you know, our sheriff is Scott Jones, someone who's regularly having meetings with Donald Trump. He's a very staunch supporter of ICE and the ICE raids, and he works very closely with the Sacramento Police Department. So, you know, SAC PD is trying to give this image of progressiveness, but at the same time, they're continuing their support for the Sacramento County Sheriff. And they're also, they haven't changed any of their conduct on the streets. And we're still seeing people have their rights violated on a regular basis. We're still waiting for actual progress. But they'll always try to tell us a new face is progress.
Yeah, it's such a dominant story. You look at the New York Times today, it's like oh, there's hope here in Sacramento.
They call him the Barack Obama of Sacramento in the Washington Post today.
And I think Jameer is completely right. It's all to divert attention from what's really actually going on. Gloria LaRiva, 1 minute left. I mean, when those cops showed up, you know, Stephen Clark was in his grandma's backyard. They shot 20 times. It all happened, I think, within 6 seconds. And then some of the media reports, too, where the police were nervous or the police were fearful. I mean, what actually precipitated the event was a call about vandalism. Some windows have been broken in the area. I mean, these cops are not afraid. I mean, this is a reign of terror. And that's really, let's call it what it is. Can you have a reign of terror against an entire people in America and still have a democracy? I don't know. I mean, go ahead. 30 seconds left. You get the final word.
It is a state of terror. And I want to say the officials are trying to divert the anger and the movement by saying that they're going to have an investigation, even the attorney general of the state. It boils down. They always boil the question down to this. Did the police fear for their lives? That's the playbook of the cops across the country. They said that about Mike Brown. And they're going to come up with that same answer. That's why the only justice will come by the people mobilized, organized, and refusing to accept their diversionary tactics.
Let's leave it right there. We're completely out of time. That was the voice of Gloria LaRiva. She is the Peace and Freedom 2018 California gubernatorial candidate. We've been joined from Sacramento by Jameer Sal. He is an activist with the Answer Coalition, and he is a principal organizer of the protests in the streets in the last days in Sacramento. And we were joined once again from Chicago by Aislinn Borsini. Aislinn is an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Israeli soldiers killed 18 Palestinians and shot more than 750 other people with live ammunition, wounding them. At least 1,400 altogether were wounded on Friday during Land Day demonstrations in Gaza. 20 Palestinians remain in critical condition. No Israelis were killed or wounded. We're going to talk about what happened Friday and what it means. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by longtime peace activist and Code Pink member Ty Berry. And we're joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutahab. He is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Welcome, Dawood and Ty.
Thank you for having me.
Ty Berry, you've been there where this incident took place. 750 shot with live ammunition. Almost 20 dead, 20 more critically wounded. Talk about what this must have been like.
Well, I've been to that border. You can't get within 300 meters of that border. There's literally a line. And that story about that these were Hamas members, I've driven to that border with people, the Hamas guards. They stop 500 meters from the border because they know the Israelis can see them. There are drones all over the place. There are balloons up over the place surveying. There are high posts there. There's an electrified fence there. They've got miles and miles and miles of wall in the West Bank. But for some reason, in Gaza, they only got a tiny little electrified fence. They claim that they're rolling burning tires at the Israeli soldiers. Actually, the Israeli soldiers have the high ground right there, so there's no way they're rolling them into there where it's going to hurt them. The other false claim that Israel is putting out is that they will come in hordes over the border. It's so far to get to the next village from where they are. It's another 2 kilometers at least to get to Sidrot or any other village anywhere around there. The every single claim by the Israeli government, and I gotta say, it's being echoed again on BBC, NPR. It's horrific reporting out of Gaza. You can't get within 300 meters of that border without getting shot. Many members of ISM, International Solidarity Movement, have been shot. Many people have been killed. just attempting to farm in that area. One parsley farmer was hit by a tank shell on Friday. It's ludicrous and a false claim that there's anything that Israel has to fear. The people of Palestine have been long suffering for far too long, and all they're doing is expressing themselves as we would force any other country in the world. If people wanted to express their desire for freedom, we would be backing them. The only place we don't back them is in Israel. It's horrific.
Daoud, there were opinion pieces today in Haaretz and in the Jerusalem Post, two major Israeli outlets, written by Israelis, by Jewish Israelis, saying that any notion that the people shot were Hamas and were not Palestinian civilians was ridiculous. That the Israeli military and police had no right to open fire on these people. This was a peaceful demonstration. It was called to be a peaceful demonstration, and that the government overreacted. So even with the Israeli media acknowledging that this was really a crime committed against civilians, why is the international press not up in arms about this?
Well, I mean, and I think the issue is, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, people are unarmed. They come to demonstrate, and you shoot them. And I mean, you don't kind of question them and check out their archives of who they are before you shoot them. And even if they were Hamas, or Hamas activists not allowed to demonstrate in an unarmed protest, what's wrong with that?
Right.
In fact, shouldn't Israel actually be applauding that Hamas is now no longer using tanks and no longer using rockets, but they're actually doing peaceful demonstrations? They should be sending them thank you. You know, I don't understand the idea that because after these were killed, they checked their identity out and they found them, there was some kind of a list, means that it's justifiable to kill these people. It's just ridiculous. But as far as international media and international press, you know, it's a story that unfortunately has been exhausted. And the press are looking for something new. I mean, what is happening actually in Gaza is something that the international press and the pundits have been saying for years. Why don't the Palestinians have their nonviolence? Where is the Palestinian Gandhi? Why don't they do peaceful demonstrations? I mean, it's so interesting. And in fact, I'm trying to draw a comparison between what's happening in America with the Black Lives Matter, and I'm saying Palestinian Lives Matter. If you think, you know, the one guy in Sacramento was killed because he was unarmed and they shot him, well, look at the 17, 18 Palestinians who were also shot, and they weren't even, you know, carrying out a, you know, like a phone that they thought was a gun or taking a stand. They were actually, they knew they were going to demonstrate for weeks and weeks before that. They've said they're going to demonstrate. There is no nothing. There's no surprise here. The only surprise is the continued criminality. That's, I mean, the surprise, as you said, is why the international community, which said Iranians should be allowed to demonstrate. That's the right for the Iranians to demonstrate. But what? The Palestinians are not allowed to demonstrate? It just doesn't make sense.
A very important point, John, because, you know, here in the United States, when we go and protest, we exercise First Amendment rights. The government and the media says, see, even if they don't like our message, see, you're protesting and you're exercising your First Amendment rights. The only questions they ask you is, will you participate in a nonviolent civil disobedience or something like that? Or do you expect a problem? But when it comes to the Palestinian Arab population, when people engage in the boycott, divest, sanctions movement, which is a peaceful movement to garner public support to say, don't buy goods from Israel because Israel is illegally occupying other people's lands and treating them in the worst despicable kinds of ways. Don't buy Israeli products. Boycott. That's treated like a criminal terrorist action. And as Daoud said, now that you have Hamas or others, or all the Palestinian groups exercising those rights to come out and say on land day, we want our land back. When you have a peaceful protest, you're also treated as a terrorist. And then, Ty, I'm looking at Western media headlines, including in the U.S., Hamas-inspired riot. I mean, talk about the Alice in Wonderland reality. You can shoot 750 people, unarmed people, with live ammunition in a single day, and the U.S. corporate-owned media calls that a Hamas-inspired riot? I mean, it can't get worse than this.
No, it can't win.
Let me start by quoting Donald Trump after every mass shooting in this country, which happens at practically every single day. These are sick puppies. First of all, Hamas is a legitimate resistance movement under the Geneva Convention. You have a right to resist occupation. This is an occupation, nonetheless, in Palestine. Even if you say that the Israeli settlers had left Palestine, they've caused this siege, which is a form of occupation. Siege is a form of occupation, and it's illegal under Geneva Convention, under international law, and the Palestinian people have the right to resist. Hamas is a legitimate political party inside Palestine, and it has the right to call for protests. These are peaceful, nonviolent protests. Let me reiterate, people in Hamas who are actually in the political party, who are security in Hamas, do not enter into the buffer zone. They know they will be sniped. Many of these people were sniped and killed. They weren't just shot at by 20-year-old racist Jewish settlers or non-settlers. And remember, many of the people in the Israeli army come from Georgia, barely are Jewish. They have some Jewish something in their past. They claim it. Their only reason for being there is to fight and kill Palestinians, super racist. And they come from all over Russia and in Eastern Europe to come there just to kill Palestinians. These are the people they put on the front lines. Now, the fact of the matter is Palestinian Land Day is a national holiday in Palestine. They informed the Israeli government that they were going to set up tents and they were going to occupy their own country to protest the illegitimate siege, the deplorable conditions that they live in. They can't even get water. Sewage is pouring into the Mediterranean, and it's pouring on their own lands. Because the Israelis have illegally, once again, destroyed the sewage systems and the water purification plants. Israel is the war criminal here. But I woke up this morning at 6 o'clock to a BBC report about a young man who had fireworks. And the reporter said, why are you shooting fireworks at the, hundreds of yards away at the border fence? And the guy said, because I have nothing left to live for. I want to die. I want to be there. That's the only person they could find to put up. And then they put, as far as the Palestinian dialogue goes and what's going on there, instead they go for, in a three-minute piece, they go for a minute and a half to Michael Oren, former ambassador from Israel to the United States, who is absolute Zionist and believes that there's never a wrong reason, as does the defense minister in Israel. There's no wrong reason for a Palestinian to die under these occupations. It's horrific. The people of this country, Jewish people in the United States, Jewish people worldwide should be appalled, and they should call on Israel to back down and to allow this peaceful, nonviolent protest, because it's going on for 6 weeks until the Nakba, the day of catastrophe, in May.
It seems, Dawood, that the Israelis went out of their way to send a message that these 6 weeks of peaceful protest will be treated in the most horrific, brutal way. These were big protests. These were big protests on Friday. 30,000 people, Gazans, people living in this outdoor prison called Gaza, living under siege, Gaza. They gathered together in spite of the fact that they knew there was risk, because even though they were peaceful, given what's happening and given the political climate in Israel and given the fact that the American government has given absolute green light, blank check to Netanyahu to do whatever he and the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, want to do to the Palestinians, in spite of that sort of fear that must exist when you even have a peaceful protest, that was a large gathering of people, 30,000. What does it mean for Land Day? What is it?
Continue.
Yeah, go ahead. Talk about what's going to happen.
Well, one of the things that the Israelis apply is a strategy called a strategy that tries to cause the other side to kind of fear. They call it some kind of a preventative strategy, or a strategy that is aimed at deterring the other side. And so what they try to do is they try to kind of go very, very high, and they really respond in an extreme, exaggerated way to kind of deter others from doing the same thing. Now, deterrence works if there is a parallel kind of a peace process. It works if the other side has something to live for. But when you lose hope, when you have nothing to hope for, when you're in, living in this big prison, you start, the deterrence ability to really deter you becomes weakened. It's eroded. And once you're able to kind of, you know, bite your tongue and say, I'm going to go out no matter what, the deterrence feels useless. And therefore, the Israelis then deter even more. They kind of raise up the bar. They try to kill more people so that, you know, more people will, less people would demonstrate the next day. And people kind of, again, go through this process of, yes, we're still going to do it. And it's an endless process where you keep trying to deter people. People are not being deterred. You're actually, you know, massacring people under this rubricule of saying, I want deterrence, this policy of deterrence. So the deterrence policy is not a defensive policy. They're not shooting people because their lives are in danger, which is actually the Israeli military code. You only are supposed to shoot to kill if your life is in danger. We haven't heard a single Israeli was even injured, let alone, nobody's injured, nobody's been touched. Nothing happened to them. And you have 750 people shot at, and, you know, Israel claims they know where every bullet went. Oh, my God, you know. Somebody in the war crimes tribunal should have something to say about these war crimes. It's just not acceptable to keep, you know, killing people who are not causing you danger, who are protesting a political problem that has been caused and has not been addressed by, you know, for years, and by people who have lost hope. You know, politicians always say, and strategists say, you have to give people a hope. You have to give them a political horizon. There is no political horizon. There is no peace talks. There's nothing going on. So that adds to the frustration, desperation, and the fact that people can stand up and say, I don't care about living anymore because life is not worth living for.
You're listening,
Brian,
to...
Brian, can I add to that?
Yes, please. Go right ahead.
So Israel calls up 30... It happens every time that they bomb and destroy Gaza, every 3 years or 2 years. Israel calls up 30,000 troops to the border. Someone, one of those, trust me, by May 15th, some Israelis in that group are going to die because they get hit by a door or somebody's driving poorly and they fall in the path of a driving truck or something happens. But it's not from a Palestinian bullet. It's not from a Palestinian F-16, which they don't have. It's not from a Palestinian drone or a tank or a shell. It's from... their own thing, but they'll count that as an injury or a casualty or a death in their armed forces, which is completely, absolutely false. As we know from the last Gaza invasion, there were many people that had heart attacks in Sidrot on their own, and they were counted as deaths in the war. And the Western media picks that up and runs with it.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are on the Sputnik News Network, and you can hear our show from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. We're talking about Gaza and the terrible killings and shootings that have taken place in Gaza over the last few days. We're joined by longtime peace activist and Code Pink member Ty Berry, and we're also joined from Amman, Jordan by Daoud Kutab, who's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Daoud, I want to ask you a question. I'm looking at an article that was just published in New York Magazine, and it's appropriately entitled, What the Hell is Happening in Gaza? And it says here that literally no one of any authority or any import in the Israeli government wants to conduct an investigation, which is what much of the international community is calling for. No one in Israel wants to conduct an investigation of what happened over the last 3 or 4 days. Do you foresee any kind of international pressure, whether it's from Jordan or the wealthy Gulf countries or even any of the Western democracies? Is there going to be any kind of political pressure on Israel to at least show some transparency over what's happened in Gaza?
Well, I one seems to have lost kind of hope in all these things, but yes, I mean, there should be. It cannot go on, and, you know, as you said, with this protest, this huge protest march, it's going to go on for 6 weeks. We're going to have, unfortunately, more and more deaths.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to die in the next 6 weeks.
And the world, as you said, is watching. And yes, the international media is not giving it enough attention. But, you know, it is something that is happening that requires some type of a neutral, bipartisan, bi-international kind of a group that comes and looks at. You know, the last time we had the Goldstone report, and they did it without actually coming. So the Israelis don't allow international investigators to arrive. They can come from the Gaza side, and they can investigate. Anyway, that's where most of the killings were happening. There's nothing to be seen from the Israeli side, and they can easily read their official statements as a kind of a balance to the report. If the Israelis don't want to cooperate, that's fine. But I think the international community has a responsibility, and they must do something about it.
You know, when you look at the Washington Post today, John, the headline, the Washington Post is very, very alarmed because they say President Trump proposed to Vladimir Putin last week that he come in and have a talk at the White House. And that set off like these alarm bells. Like something terrible would happen if they
actually...
Yeah,
like that's a really bad idea to engage in diplomacy.
Awful. But, you know, outside of that kind of alarmist sort of headline, there's nothing alarmist at all about the fact that the Israeli government, which is funded by American taxpayers, I mean, the U.S. Gives more money to Israel than to any other country in the world, more economic aid and more military aid. And so it's underwriting Israeli... military violence against peaceful protesters. But again, the things that bother the Washington Post or the New York Times are not this. It's not the fact that the Israeli government is being provided with all it needs to carry out this awful, terrible crime against humanity and war crimes and crimes against peace. In other words, the trifecta of Nuremberg-type crimes. That's not what's bothering the Washington Post. What's bothering the Washington Post is that Trump talked to Putin. I mean, it really says so much about why the American people have been largely kept sort of out of the loop, because the corporate-owned media, that's an opinion-molding instrument, does not do what it could easily do. I mean, if there was any other government in the world, I would say, or let's say North Korea shot 750 people on Friday.
Right.
Would we be? Would that be the top news? Would that be a call to arms?
We would be sending battleships off the coast. Yeah.
No. Go ahead.
I just got to say, you know, name another country that can shoot unarmed people from a high advantage point, a military, and get 17, 18 people and get away with it. Even the Rohingya in Myanmar, when they're killed, even our government will come out and say, we denounce this. There's already been a vote in the UN. And the United States blocked the vote to denounce the killings in Gaza. There, you know, it's just appalling. On Friday, I'm listening to these stories. Clashes on the Israeli border. There's no clash. You need another unit to another side to a clash. These are peaceful, nonviolent protesters. They said there are weapons at the border. BBC described them as fireworks and slingshots, throwing rocks, throwing burning tires uphill to Israeli positions. With armed soldiers, tanks, missiles, all kinds of things, F-16s flying over Gaza every single hour. It's horrific. The United States, the Jewish community, especially in the United States, because I know that Black Lives Matter was tweeting about this, and the Jewish community in the United States got all up in arms about the fact that the Black Lives Matter were supporting the Palestinians' right to exist, the right to have their own lives, and the right to have their own country. It's appalling. I'm these are liberal media, NPR, Frantz Van Kot, BBC, the liberal media, forget CNN, they won't even cover this. And they give it like 2 minutes, and then they'll go to a junk piece for 5 minutes on an art show somewhere in the world and they won't cover a catastrophe that's happening right there in Palestine.
Let's talk, Daoud, about what Land Day is, why this is has such universal significance among the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I mean, this is important, actually, to point out that this was not done on the occasion of the Jewish Passover. I mean, that was not chosen. Passover is decided on the lunar calendar, and it changes every year. And Palestinians every year on March 30th go on a protest, because in 1976, in Israel, actually, Palestinian Arabs who are citizens of Israel were complaining that their land was being confiscated to build Jewish settlements in Israel. I mean, they're taking away from Palestinian Arab citizens, and 13 Palestinian citizens of Israel were killed that day. And that became a kind of an annual day for protest. But what is happening in Gaza, starting on Land Day, but it will continue until the Nakba Day, May 15th, which is also supposedly the day that the U.S. will make the kind of symbolic move of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So, yeah, Land Day is a commemoration which tries to say this conflict is about land, that Israelis have a lust for land, that this is not, they're not interested in peace, they're more interested in the P-I-E-C-E, the piece of land, rather than P-E-A-C-E. And that's why the protests, they try to focus on the land. And in Gaza, where the majority of the population are actually refugees from what is now Israel, they kind of use the right of return, which is enshrined in a UN resolution, number 194, that calls on the Israel to allow Palestinian refugees to return and be compensated. So there is a combination of both the struggle for the land and the right of return.
That's the voice of Daoud Kutab. Daoud is an award-winning journalist. He's won.
And I may say, I just published a book in the U.S. called Sesame Street Palestine by Bear Manor. So have your listeners look it up and read it.
Yeah, we certainly will. Give us the title one more time, Daoud.
Sesame Street Palestine. It's a story of trying to do a simple project to bring Sesame Street into Palestine and all the political complications that we faced as we tried to bring a children's program to the Palestinian children.
Ty Berry, let me go back to you. We have about 2 minutes left. I was looking just now at an announcement by your organization, Code Pink. There will be demonstrations today at the White House. I know I'm part of the Answer Coalition. We've been demonstrating in different cities throughout the weekend after this terrible massacre, and will continue to do so. Just talk about what people can do in the United States, people especially who are listening to this show in the Washington, D.C. area. We have 1 minute left. How can people get involved?
Well, we're going to be at the White House. We're calling on everyone in the community to come out and express their outrage to these murders that are taking place in Gaza. And remember, I want people to remember, the weekend before this, the Land Day, the liberal caucus from Congress, you saw Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, all these big shots in the Democrat Party were there in Palestine, I mean, in Israel, getting a photo op with this war criminal, Netanyahu, smiling and being happy with them. And a week later, people are getting murdered, mass murdered on their frontier in their own country. We need to call on all these liberal Democrats to step outside and say, hey, enough is enough. We are not going to put up with this kind of mass murder of the Palestinian people. And I've also got to point out, remember, Gaza is 45 kilometers by 8 kilometers. Israel declares a 500-meter buffer zone, so it's really only 7.5 kilometers. All the arable land, anywhere there's farms, are all in the eastern side of Gaza. That's where the border fence is. So they're trying to cut off the availability of Palestinians to even grow their own food. Israel is a war criminal nation, and it needs to be stopped. It's very, very, very important that we have a big showing and tell this government that they need to step out and do the right thing once.
All right. That's the voice of Ty Berry. Ty is a member of Code Pink. He's a longtime peace activist. We've also been joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutab. He is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. His latest book is Sesame Street, Palestine, The Ups and Downs of Producing a Children's Show in Palestine. We want to thank both of our guests. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.